Good afternoon, everybody. And welcome to those of you here in the auditorium as well as those joining us by phone. I am Vicki Robinson, Senior Advisor for Healthcare Reform for the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services. Actually, until recently, I served in a different position where I spent many years working almost exclusively on Stark, kickback, and civil money penalty matters. Joining me as co-moderator for today's panel is Troy Barsky, Director of CMS's Division of Technical Payment Policy, where he leads the CMS team that addresses Stark Law issues. We are also joined today in the auditorium by colleagues from our offices, the Department of Justice, the Internal Revenue Service, and the Federal Trade Commission. We are delighted to have with us today a distinguished panel to discuss the intersection of Stark, anti-kickback, and the civil money penalty law with accountable care organizations and similar integrated models. During the next 70 minutes or so, our panel will bring their varied perspectives to this topic. During the listening session that will follow, we invite all of you in the room and on the phones to offer your views on these subjects as well. So let me introduce our panel. To my right is Ivy Baer, who is Director and Regulatory Counsel for the American Association of Medical Colleges, and I just managed to. It is the Association of American Medical Colleges. I apologize. Seated next to her is Jonathan Diesenhaus, who is the Fraud and Abuse Counsel for the American Hospital Association. And then next to him is Jeffrey Miklos, Executive Vice President for Management, Compliance, and General Counsel for the Federation of American Hospitals. Next we have Robert Sainer, Washington Counsel for the Medical Group Management Association. Next to him, Chester Chet Speed, Vice President for Public Policy of the American Medical Group Association, followed by Nora Super, Director of Government Relations for AARP. And then we have joining us Jan Towers, who is Health Policy Director for the American Academy of Nurse Practitioners. And seated next to her is Tom Wilder, who is Senior Regulatory Counsel for America's Health Insurance Plans. And finally, at the end of the table, we have Marcy Zackheim, who is counsel for the National Association of Community Health Centers. And we thank you all for being with us today. Before we get started, we wanted to take a few minutes to provide some context for this afternoon's discussion and for the listening session for the benefit of our audience here and on the phone. As was described this morning, accountable care organizations are, very broadly speaking, groups of providers and practitioners that work together to manage and coordinate patient care and are accountable for the quality and cost of that care. As we have been discussing today, the Affordable Care Act contains several provisions that incorporate ACOs into the Medicare and Medicaid programs. The focus of our panel this afternoon is how ACOs will interact with the Stark Law, the kickback statute, and the civil money penalties law. Many have observed that these laws create potential barriers to innovation and development of accountable care organizations and similar models. As the Inspector General said this morning, as Medicare and Medicaid programs move to incorporate and test payment and delivery models, there is a need for fresh thinking about program integrity and the types of risks for programs and patients. Now, as most of you know, the Stark Law prohibits physicians from referring Medicare patients for certain designated health services, including hospital services, to entities with which they have a prohibited financial relationship. The entities cannot bill Medicare for improperly referred services, and fitting in one of the many exceptions is mandatory. The anti-kickback statute is an intent-based criminal law that, very broadly speaking, prohibits the purposeful buying and selling of any federal health care program business. Now, there are a number of voluntary safe harbors that protect some arrangements. These two referral laws seek to prevent overutilization, increased costs, and improper steering of patients motivated by financial interest. Now, the civil money penalty law is a little different. It arises in the context of the hospital prospective payment system, and it prohibits hospitals from paying physicians to reduce or limit services to hospital patients under the physician's care. It addresses the risk that hospitals will pay physicians to reduce costs by limiting the care that patients receive. These fraud and abuse laws operate on the general principle that programs and patients can best be protected by prohibiting or limiting financial relationships between referral sources and referral recipients.
So, I'd like to just focus on the challenge for today. As Vicki said, these laws constrain financial relationships between parties in a position to generate federal health care referrals. Therefore, models that integrate providers into systems of shared financial interests and referrals, such as accountable care organizations, potentially implicate these statutes. Now Congress provided the Secretary of Health and Human Services with a tool to address these impediments that are created by these statutes, which is waiver authority, specifically in Section 3021 of the Affordable Care Act, dealing with demonstrations and pilots, and Section 3022 of the Affordable Care Act, dealing with the Medicare Shared Savings Program, were expressly authorized to waive the fraud and abuse laws as necessary to carry out these important statutory provisions. In addition, CMS and the OIG have the authority to create additional exceptions or safe harbors as necessary. What we are considering now is how to best use these various authorities separately or in combination in the context of ACOs and other integrated care delivery models. And by way of background, in 2008, CMS proposed just such an exception for shared savings and incentive payment programs. CMS received significant public comment, but we did not finalize the proposal. Given the more recent developments, including passage of the Affordable Care Act, CMS is engaged in new thinking about the best ways to address shared savings and other performance-based programs. Furthermore, CMS has begun work in crafting proposed regulations for the 3022 Shared Savings Program, and we expect to issue proposed regulations shortly. Now, turning to the panel discussion today, we've organized our discussion into basically three main broad categories. We first wanted to talk about how the Secretary may exercise her waiver authority with regard to these fraud and abuse laws that Vicki mentioned a moment ago. Next, we want to focus on safeguards that we may need to implement to both protect patients and also protect the integrity of federal programs that should be included in the design of any accountable care organization. And then, finally, we want to conclude by a discussion of the future. And moving beyond our explicit waiver authority, what other possible safe harbors and exceptions should we be considering in order to facilitate the creation of accountable care organizations? Further, as we move forward with our discussion today, for those of you who joined us in the morning, we would just like to remind all of our participants, both on the panel and in our second listening session, about Dr. Berwick's triple aim goals, which is to focus on better care, better health for populations, and lower cost per capita, and how we might work to fulfill those goals. We are interested in exploring how we at HHS can most effectively ensure that the fraud and abuse laws are not a barrier to improving quality and reducing costs through accountable care organizations. Now, in reading some of the comments that we received before this panel or before this workshop over the past week or two, we noted that there are a range of views on the exercise of our waiver authority and other mechanisms as needed and what conditions may be applied, and we're looking forward to exploring that further today. Those comments are now posted on the Federal Trade Commission's website, and they will be posted on linked to from the OIG's website as well as CMS's website in the coming days. Now, just a few ground rules for today. Similarly to this morning, we will be asking the questions organized around these certain themes. For this first session, we'll be focused on listening to our panelists that we've assembled here. For the second session, we will be opening up the microphones on the floor and then also listening to folks on the phone and receiving comments from them. We're asking all the speakers, both on the panel and then also on the phone, to please limit your comments to no more than 2 minutes. So that we can work to get, so that we can work to listen to all the varied views amongst our panelists. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Vicki for a first question, and we can get started.
Great. And just we're going to adopt a method that was used this morning to identify when people want to get in the conversation. If you will tip your name card up if you want to get in, we will also be calling on certain folks during this panel. So we're going to start with talking about waivers and what the waiver authority might look like and what we might need to be considering when we're thinking about this waiver authority. And so the first question is this. It has been suggested that waiving the application of Stark, kickback, and the CMP to the distribution of shared savings will positively impact the development of ACOs. We'd like to know if you agree or disagree with that statement. And if the HHS agencies decide to exercise the waiver authority in this direction, do you have any recommendations on what needs to be stated in the waiver to accomplish these goals? And I'm going to start with Bob Sainer representing MGMA, and then we will move through other panelists who are interested in this question.
Thank you, Vicki, and good afternoon. I don't think it will surprise the audience or my fellow panelists that I am a strong advocate for waivers. I think they are necessary if the agency wants to get this program off the ground quickly and expand it rapidly beyond the very large integrated systems that are already in it. In terms of what you should say in connection with the waiver authority, I think you should say as little as possible. I think you should provide a one-sentence waiver of the three authorities that we're talking about this afternoon. And I say that for several reasons. One, I think you really need flexibility. Somebody on the panel late this morning said we need the permission to experiment, and I think that applies in spades to accountable care organizations, and I think it is as important with respect to these fraud and abuse authorities as it is with respect to the antitrust authorities. Speed helps you get up and running. Reduces the costs, the sort of transactional costs for the people who want to participate and put these accountable care organizations together. And I think it levels the playing field to some degree. Clearly, the very large integrated systems have a head start in this game, and they have certain advantages under the fraud and abuse laws if they are large nonprofit integrated systems. We view ACOs as an opportunity to bring smaller groups and contractual arrangements of perhaps many smaller groups into the ACO field, and I think if you go down the path of many safe harbors and new stark exceptions, we will get mired in detail. Therefore, I'm a strong advocate for waivers.
Great. Tom.
Sure, thank you. I guess I'd take a bit of a contrary view, and I would not automatically start with the assumption that Stark and the anti-kickback laws and CMP are somehow this great impediment to ACOs. We heard from the panel discussion this morning that there are a lot of these kinds of organizations or ACO-like entities that have been in operation for a while and numbers that are forming. And so I think as a regulator, I would start with no assumption one way or the other. And what I would say to those groups that are have either operating ACO-like entities now or looking to form them, I would say, okay, what are the 5 or 6 or 10 things that you really want to accomplish that you think improve patient care, that you think, you know, will address some of the cost issues that you believe the current structure doesn't permit, and then let's build safe harbors or exceptions around that. And again, I'm not saying yes or no. I'm saying instead of giving this kind of blanket, they're a problem, let's do away with them, let's focus on the specific questions that people are struggling with. And the second point I would raise is I think to some extent, to me, the process of developing those exceptions or waivers are as important as what they actually say. And I credit both the FTC and CMS and OIG for starting that discussion process. And as you know, under the APA, there's a process where any kind of regulations or guidance, you get public comment and then consider that first. I would just very quickly, as you know, there's been a lot of regulations that has come out so far under the Affordable Care Act on a very fast basis, and then subsequently the regulators have had to issue all sorts of guidance and enforcement safe harbors because the rules came out so quickly that they didn't really anticipate all of the issues. So I think it's important that the regulators get it right from the starting point, and really whatever you're thinking about doing, push it out and let people react to that and then say, okay, these are the rules going forward.
Right. Thank you. I'm seeing a forest of tents, so I'm going to call people as I saw them come up. Jeff Nicklaus.
Thank you, Vicki, and thank you to you and Troy and all of your colleagues for having this. It's an important session for us, and I think I would agree with Bob. I think that history with regard to gain sharing over the past several years and all the debate about that shows that clearly there's a need for some relief under the fraud and abuse laws to be able to make a shared savings arrangement work. And so I think we're seeing it in the context of an ACO now, but it's really a problem that's been out there for a while that probably needs to be dealt with. So I clearly think that would enhance innovation. The one point I think, the context of everyone who's answered the question, I think, is the right context, but I want to make sure we put on the table that the waiver authority is something that's a little bit different, really, in a real live program. We've seen waivers in the past with regard to demonstration projects, but with regard to pilot programs and clearly the 3022 shared savings, this is real. And so the question that we've had some debate about is really, is the waiver appropriately applied in the context of giving everybody a level playing field, or will the government be looking to potentially provide waivers to individual ACOs who may come in and present a particular type of arrangement? And we think the former is the right way to go. We think to the extent that you are waiving requirements that are going to foster the growth of ACOs, it should be done in a uniform way to create a level playing field.
Great. Ivy Baer.
Hi, Ivy Baer, Association of American Medical Colleges. We represent both teaching hospitals and physicians, and so we've got a little integration going on ourselves. And I want to say I was glad that Troy mentioned that the waiver authority is in two sections, 3021 and 3022, 22 being the ACOs, but 3021 includes the ability to waive for a variety of models, including healthcare innovation zones, which would be formed around teaching hospitals. We support Bob Sehner in that I think waivers should be very broad and they should be quick, but I think that a few sentences more than the one that Bob suggested, that if an ACO or a model that's approved under 3021 has CMS approval so that it has in it the safeguards and the monitoring that we think will protect the program and the patients, then the waiver should follow. Speed and flexibility are really essential in this whole process, and we don't think a long regulatory process would be beneficial.
Thank you. Jonathan Diesenhaus.
Hi, Jonathan Diesenhaus, here for the American Hospital Association. I'd take a half step back, actually, and think about the question of waiver versus safe harbor in terms of what STARC, the safe harbor, the CMP statute, what their focus is. Their focus is on risks presented by an older model of healthcare. And what Congress has said is throw those away, break down the silos, as folks at the AHA want to say, and develop an integrated approach to delivering care so we can meet the goals that were discussed this morning. The Anti-Kickback Statute and STARC and the CMP look at that old model and impose very significant penalties, made even worse by, in my law enforcement world, you know, by QI-TAM relators, whistleblowers, the False Claims Act, really souping up the penalties. So safe harbors and exceptions are designed within a statutory framework that doesn't favor innovation, that doesn't favor flexibility, that proscribes the types of transactions that will be protected from these penalties. And if you're a half inch outside, you're subject to those penalties. So the consequence is twofold. It discourages innovation because it's very narrow, very focused, and very upfront, structurally limiting on what the transaction can be. But the penalties, the existence of the penalties, also discourages risk-averse participants from engaging in the process of innovation. And I think that's, in this reform environment, that's the worst case. And so if the choice is between designing STARC exceptions and safe harbors the way we've come to understand them, with a checklist of what the documents need to look like on the front end, or waiver, then I choose waiver. I don't think waiver means an unlevel playing field. I think you can do it, as Jeff says, that it can be across the board. And I also think it can be structured in a way where you to qualify for the waiver, I guess I disagree with Ivy. I don't think a case-by-case approval of an ACO to qualify for the waiver would lend any, well, it would just put a lot of paper on people's desks and it wouldn't move very fast. But some set of safeguards, and I'm going to go all the way to the end, I know I'm taking more than 2 minutes, but, you know, in the fraud and abuse world, We received guidance from the Inspector General and from CMS about the need to have effective auditing, monitoring, and compliance. And what we're talking about in the big picture is accountable care organizations. So if the organizations have, as a minimum criteria, internal self-policing, accountability, and a real measure of integration that takes into account accountability, so that the entity is taking action on this information that it's gathering, that it's actually moving forward, not a sham integration to pass money back and forth, but a real integration through which reform of the practice of medicine and reduction of cost occurs, and that can be monitored on the back end. That would be a way to qualify for waiver, have a structure that allows for output and measures outcome.
Great. Thank you. Chet Speed, you've had your card up for quite a while, so we'll recognize you.
Hi, Chet Speed with the American Medical Group Association. I think we would favor a waiver. That rhymes. And I come from it from an ACO development standpoint. As many of you know, the ACO statute was largely based, or in part, on the experiences of the physician group practice demonstration participants, nine of which were AMJ members, thankfully for us. One of the things that we learned from them was that the startup costs for the PGP demonstration were about $1 million, and much of that was fixed for personnel. And the maintenance costs to continue these care management processes in place, which are necessary to tightly manage a chronically ill patient population, were also in the seven-figure mark. And so when you think about those participants were fairly sophisticated on the integration scale, and they had a lot of things already in place, structure-wise, EMRs being one. But when you think about seven-figure investment figures to even begin the process of being an ACO, I think a lot of potential ACOs would like some type of clarity from OIG and CMS regarding, you know, that there is a waiver of the fraud abuse statutes, because it's difficult for them to put in that type of investment and not know with some degree of certainty that they are within fraud abuse statutes.
Great, thank you. I think we'll take one more for this very popular question and then move on. But Jan Towers.
One of the things that people in my framework are very concerned about is unintended consequences. Nurse practitioners are generally thought to be employees, but indeed 6% of 140,000 of them have their own practices. And one of the things that we're very concerned about is making sure that we get included in whatever develops here as full partners so that we can continue to provide care to our patients. One of the things that can happen, and so we're just cautioning and saying please keep an eye out for this sort of thing, is that you can find when groups get together to negotiate things with waivers that there is an opportunity sometimes for collusion that needs to be protected in a way that there cannot be a leaving out or an exclusion, a deliberate exclusion of a certain class of providers. And so one of the cautions that we would have is that in order to maintain that level playing field and allow patients to have a choice of the patient, of the provider that they want to see, that indeed you need to keep this in the back of your mind as you're looking at waivers, so that those groups are protected. And the other non-physician provider groups probably have a very similar kind of framework.
Great. Thank you.
So moving on to the next question, and Marcia, we'll definitely get to you next time. And I think a lot of the panelists have already started to delve into this question, but I wanted to drill down a little deeper. Let's assume for a second that HHS does exercise the waiver authority with regard to shared savings. We've heard in various comments we've received and discussions that we've had that perhaps the waiver may need to apply to other type of financial arrangements, business arrangements, that may need to be created in order to facilitate accountable care organizations. Just as one example, and something that was discussed at length this morning, is electronic health records and the use of electronic health records. So I wanted to explore what else HHS might want to consider as we think about exercising the waiver authority and sort of moving beyond just the distribution of shared savings. What other financial arrangements might we want to think about? And we can I'll leave it open to anyone who might want to jump in, and then I could start calling on people as well. Sure.
I guess this is the old thing about age before beauty. I think this is a tougher question. I think this is a considerably tougher question for you as policymakers. I would think at a minimum you should extend waiver protection to the upfront capitalization of whatever the ACO organization or entity is. EHR, other IT expenditures, initial staffing. There would be no protection for most of those things if one participant in an APO were to contribute more staff than another participant. There would be no protection for those kinds of financial transfers under the kickback law or the Stark law as they now exist. So, and I think it will be almost impossible to start ACOs quickly if each potential collaboration among otherwise independent providers has to come up with the same formula for sharing those upfront costs. I wouldn't begin to know how to do it. You know, what share should a hospital pay if a hospital's part of it? If it's a primary care base and 10 specialty practices, how do you allocate the share of those costs so that no regulator could ever say there was an imbalance there that must have reflected a kind of underhanded subsidy of a referee to a referor. So I think you will need that kind of upfront protection under the waiver. I think when you go beyond that, it gets more difficult. And I don't know that there are easy answers to what you do to other financial relationships that might predate the formation of the ACO or that might come into being after the ACO is already operating. May not have anything really to do with the ACO, but they are financial relationships between these other participants. Presumably, if they're pre-existing, they're already protected in some fashion, at least if they have Stark implications. Presumably, they're already protected in some fashion, so they may not need the waiver to the same degree as the distribution of the savings and the startup capitalization.
Ivy Bear.
Ivy Bear, AMC. I can't add specifics, but the question is sort of a follow-up to Jonathan's remarks. It's, again, starting to think in the paradigm that we're used to thinking in, because Stark is all about financial relationships. So let's think about those that need to be protected. And maybe the thing to do is, we originally talked about waivers and being broad and being flexible. And maybe we need the protections come elsewhere, as I suggested earlier, and it's not that we should be setting out every relationship that needs the protection, because we'll never get them all, because we're staying in the same boxes if we do that.
Great. Chet.
Sorry. As I was thinking, we're, for OIG and CMS, it is a difficult question. Where do you draw the line, even if there is a waiver? But as I think about some of the relationships that may occur as ACOs are developed, if you're a physician practice, for instance, and you want to develop an ACO, presumably you may want to partner with a hospital. So that obviously brings in a range of Stark and kickback and CMP concerns. You may want to also look at teaming up with a SNF or a home health agency. I mean, if ACOs are going to be integrated and provide a comprehensive level of services, the arrangements would span the gamut from, you know, Part A, B, well, I guess that's pretty much it. But so I guess if there's going to be if you're all considering a fairly broad waiver, I think it's important to keep all those potential arrangements in mind. And we can talk about what the idea of, there's obviously going to be some sort of trade-off for that protection, because the programs have to be protected as well.
Great. We'll just go to Marcy, and then I think we'll move on to our next question.
It's a very interesting question as far as whether to waive the other elements of the ACO development. And I think if you don't do that, if you don't either waive or protect the other types of arrangements within the ACO, the waiver of the shared savings is protecting the outcome of the ACO. It's not protecting the inner workings of how you get to that. It's not protecting the development of the ACO. And without doing that, whether it's through a waiver or through the use of existing safe harbors or something to that effect, although, you know, if the goal is to try and get up as quickly as possible, the most effective way would be using waivers as opposed to trying to rely on a combination of the waivers and the safe harbors and exceptions currently. We keep going back to the idea of the waiver is so that we're not chilling the innovation and we're not chilling the ability of providers to develop these integrated systems. If we're not flexible in the development portion of it as opposed to just on the outcome, then I think we go right back to the fact that it's a chilling effect and it's just not going to be a workable program.
Great.
Okay, let's shift to a new topic or a related topic. We've talked a little bit about sort of the scope of the waiver and what arrangements it might cover, but I'd like to explore for a moment the types of providers that a waiver might cover, that a waiver might apply to many different types of providers and different types of arrangements. And so I'd like to talk for a moment about the different types of business arrangements that may need a waiver in order to function and the different types of providers and whether there are differences that need to be recognized. So different kinds of business arrangements may include the hospital physician group practice joint ventures or other affiliations, when there may be differences related to small versus large group practices, rural versus non-rural providers, physician practitioners versus other kinds of physician practitioners, and whether those differences, are there things we need to be considering about those differences. Marcia, you have your tent up first, so we'll, it was a false alarm tent. If anybody would like to jump in, or I can certainly ask. Dan, do you want to talk for a moment about the practitioner's issue?
Well, bottom line is, since I'm representing nurse practitioners, I'm going to use this as the example. But for nurse practitioners, when we have our own practices, they're very similar to the structure of a physician practice. So we have the same problems that a small physician practice would have. And we certainly have had discussions with some of the family physicians and the rural physicians who worry about the same thing in terms of what happens to the little guy. And, of course, we sort of, I guess, fit into that little guy framework because we are small businesses. But the problems would be the same. We have another framework of practice we call nurse-managed centers. These function a lot like federally qualified health centers. They are tied many times to academic health centers. And there possibly could be other kinds of issues related to that because we already know that because they are tied to academic health centers and don't have their own community boards that make them freestanding, that they don't qualify for federally qualified health clinic funds at this point in time. So those are the kinds of things that we would have. We do have nurse practitioners who have arrangements with hospitals, and so the same kind of problems that any physician would have with that would fit into our business framework as well.
Great. Thank you. Jeff Nicholas.
excuse me. I think that obviously from a hospital perspective, just in our own world, you see so many different types, whether it's a physician-hospital organization or whether it's just hospitals that have employed physicians, which are probably a little bit easier to analyze currently. But if you have hospitals with a community-based hospital with a predominantly voluntary medical staff, the issues get a little bit thornier. And so just in our space, you see a bunch of different models. And when you think about kind of what you've posed in the question as far as rural versus urban and different provider type, I just think you really begin to complicate matters significantly. And you're going to really have to tread lightly without creating, I think, an undue impact on the market. I really do think that it needs to be a level playing field. If you're an ACO and you're achieving the policy objectives of the ACO, really what your characteristics or your demographics are really shouldn't be that big of an impact, in my view. I think you really probably create more complexities than necessary.
Great. Tom Wilder.
Thanks. I think there's a lot of different types of arrangements that may form as ACOs, and I think you need to give them the flexibility to flourish. I would think about it in terms of two issues. The first is, are there certain types of arrangements that raise a heightened risk of some kind of improper relationship, some kind of improper referral or financial relationship? So that's one piece of the puzzle you need to look at. And the other one, quite frankly, is regulatory burden. Obviously, a smaller physician practice, they don't need a lot of kind of regulatory requirements layered on top of whatever they do now. So I think size, to me, matters in that particular perspective as well.
Great. Nora Super.
Yes, hi. I'm Nora Super with AARP. Just wanted to go back to, it seems people are going, you know, around this question of, do we want to provide these waivers so we can have as many as possible and everyone flourish and or get to the outcome of what the policy objective is of the accountable care organizations. And I think that I'd fall on the side of making sure that that we stick to what the policy objective is. I mean, they are called accountable care organizations, and we want to make sure that they're accountable to the patients. I know that people want to have this market opportunity and see the ability to improve the delivery system, which we certainly support, but I think there is a risk that the patients will be going to systems that aren't fully able to achieve the objectives that are laid out in the statute. And so you need to make sure that that criteria are clearly set, and I think that the types of organizations that are able to achieve that are different, and you can't just have a blanket waiver for all organizations because they want to participate.
Great, thank you. I think with that we may move on. I know tents are popping up, and we have more questions in this area, but we want to be sure to cover the major topics. So I'm going to ask, maybe we will move on, and hopefully you can work your thoughts into other questions. So we're going to, I think, now turn to the question that Troy mentioned at the beginning about safeguards and what kinds of safeguards we might need to consider in connection with waivers, exceptions, and safe harbors and these various issues.
And I think that this point or these series of questions sort of gets to what some of you have raised of sort of the larger policy questions and policy issues sort of underlying the exercise of the waiver. And so as this part of the discussion, I think what we really want to focus on is moving away from the waiver itself, thinking about either the regulations that CMS will put out with regard to the 3022 program or other models or demonstrations that we may be exploring over the coming months and years. What type of issues or concepts should we be making sure that we incorporate into the programs themselves to serve as a safeguard to really get at the policy goals, which we've all been discussing? And specifically, I wanted to start with something that was discussed this morning about patient-centeredness and how we create accountable care organizations, assuming that we will exercise some waiver authority, how we will focus on the protection of patients or focusing on patients and focusing on giving the best quality care to individuals. Nora, I'm going to actually ask you to pick up and start again and maybe sort of continue with some of the comments that you gave a few moments ago to really address this issue about patients and patient-centeredness.
Okay, thank you very much. It's a very interesting question, and several of us were discussing it over lunch as well and have been discussing it as we think about ways, of course, that people will either be assigned to an ACO or have it assigned to them, and whether or not that will be transparent to the patient. And I think from AARP's perspective, we think that the ACOs should demonstrate to the patients that there are benefits to seeking care within the ACO. I think from the Medicare perspective, this can be difficult. We were sort of grappling with this. I think quality measurement, of course, will be critical in making sure that people know what these performance measurements are and understanding how they vary by the performance measurement. Looking at the cost equation, though, is more difficult for Medicare patients since the vast majority of them have Medicare supplemental coverage. So cost isn't going to be something that will be that they'll compete as much on. So I think patient-centeredness really has to be the core of how ACOs demonstrate why they may be better choices from others, and looking at patient-centeredness in a different way that many of different demonstrations or other quality organizations have begun to do in terms of how patients actually receive care, if it's, you know, measured based on patient experience, which I think will be really important to be demonstrated by the accountable care organizations if it's going to be a meaningful way to them for them to make choices and determine how they seek care.
Anyone else on the panel before we move on to the next question? Jan?
One of the things that I think does happen when you hear discussions about assigning patients to an ACO, and a lot of that discussion centers around the patients that nobody wants, and that's the high-risk patients, the poor, the socially disadvantaged, it does send a bit of a chill up our backs in relation to really allowing everybody to have choice of provider and getting the kind of care that they deserve and want. And so if we're really truly being patient-centered, we really need to think about that whole concept.
Robert?
I disagree just so slightly on a couple of points. I don't disagree that it should be transparent to the patients. I think if the patients are going to be assigned to an ACO, they should know they've been assigned to an ACO. But I don't view it in the same way you would view marketing considerations in a competing health maintenance organization or other highly structured managed care environment. As I understand it, these patients are already there. When you take the primary care base that you need for any one of these organizations to work, the patients are essentially already there. And at least in the short run, I don't think you can impose an obligation on the ACO or the primary care base of the ACO to go out and sort of market the advantages of its approach. This is an effort to take existing care systems and better organize them to achieve better quality and a slower rate of growth in costs. More than it is, I think, to move patients from one care setting to another. In the long run, ACOs, if they're successful, will be competing with everybody, and they'll all be competing to move patients from the ACO next door to their ACO. But in the short run, I don't think that's the primary issue.
Okay. Chet Speed.
Sure, on the potential the patient safeguard question, I think yeah, I can't speak for all of the AMJ members, but I think the vast majority would certainly support the idea of transparency, particularly for on the quality improvement side of things. We think about the PGP demo, and I apologize for keep going back to the PGP demo, but that's where we got a lot of our feedback from. They had 32 measures that they reported on, all focusing on high cost, high volume disease conditions, and they were publicly reported. Their cost savings were also publicly reported by CMS. That's I think someone mentioned it, a thornier issue. But I think ACOs would certainly largely agree to be transparent on the quality improvement side. And to Nora's point about patients should know that they're an ACO, we would fully support that also. The problem, I think, is actually a CMS challenge, and that's one of attribution. I think a lot of patients may not know they're an ACO, and the ACO won't find out who their patients are either, perhaps until 12 months after a performance year. So I think ACOs would certainly support their patients knowing they're an ACO, and perhaps prospective attribution is a way to get at that very issue.
Thank you. Marcy, we'll finish with you, and then I think we'll turn to our next question.
I just want to reiterate something and add a little more to something that was already mentioned, and that's having to do with the patients who are the underserved patients who are currently patients of participants within these ACOs. I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is really focusing not just on quality improvement but evidence-based or outcome-based criteria and measurements. I think if we get too lost in the cost savings side of this equation, what we'll end up seeing is a negative impact on the safety net and potentially a negative impact on safety net providers participating in these ACOs. So I think it's very important to keep that in mind when we're talking about measurements or patient protections to ensure that we're going down the path of really looking at that evidence-based, outcome-based types of measurements so that we can ensure that we don't end up with the safety net folks kind of falling through a gap.
Great. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I think we'll shift to another topic now, one that was touched on, I think, in an earlier response. I'd like to talk about what types of monitoring the government should perhaps require in order to best serve patients and to ensure that ACOs are improving health care quality and efficiency, whether that should be self-monitoring, whether it should be government monitoring. And then in connection with this, although this is a topic that cross-cuts, I think, across a number of issues for today's panel, what role might health IT and electronic health records play in these systems? And I see Tom Wilder has his tent up, so we'll start there.
Oh, sure. I'll pitch this one out. I think there's really three components. I do think self-monitoring is an important function, and I think one of the requirements for ACOs is they have a compliance plan in place. And I think one of the things that you as regulators can do to help out is maybe put some structure around a model, what that would look like. Again, I recognize there's not, you know, one size fits all, but I think helping ACOs that are starting up understanding kind of what the compliance expectations are, how that would look. I think it'll be interesting to see what role accreditation might play in some of these groups like NCQA and others in terms of providing standards for ACOs. And finally, I do think the government needs to, keep an eye on the development of ACOs and see how they're working in the context of Stark and anti-kickback and CMP, and I just think it's useful in any kind of exercise like this to build in a feedback loop so that at some point down the road, everybody just takes a step back and says, okay, is this working to promote, you know, quality health care? Is this working to help deal with some of the cost issues? Are there some things that we're seeing that, you know, unintended or not, you know, we think are causing problems from a Stark standpoint? So I think there's kind of three components to this, and I think just at the end of the day, kind of taking a look to say, okay, is this really working the way we intended?
Great, thank you. I think we'll just work our way down the table. Nora?
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to go back to, you know, something I said earlier. Again, they're called accountable care organizations. So I think that the expectation is that they will be held accountable. I think self-monitoring is important. I don't think it necessarily has to be the government. I think Tom raised an excellent point that we should go to a lot of the, you know, we don't need to reinvent the wheel here. There are a lot of very good performance measurement tools that are already in place that should be relied upon. But we also need to make sure that there are meaningful ways for patients to know how these organizations are being held accountable and ways that they can look at these shared savings. It should be transparent to people. Again, when you started your comments and talked about Stark and anti-kickback, you talked about how it's improper steering of patients motivated by financial interests. And I think people always generally think of that as overutilization. But I know that, you know, most of us in the room are certainly old enough to remember the managed care backlash of the 80s. And so I just really fear that if we don't take this seriously and think about how patients may think about doctors not talking to them and showing to them why this is value for them to actually be lowering cost and higher quality, that we'll see that all over again unless we really think about this carefully.
Great, thank you. Bob?
I think the accountability for clinical metrics has been an essential part of the group practice demonstration project that precedes this, and I would just presume that both self-monitoring and some degree of reporting with respect to clinical metrics would be a part of it going forward. And that gets you to the subject of EHRs and other IT expenditures. I don't know how a large accountable care organization responsible for a large primary care base of Medicare patients is going to be able to either self-monitor or report without pretty sophisticated systems. At the same time, I would urge you not to make full implementation of those sophisticated systems a sort of front-end requirement for getting into the ACO business. MGMA's most recent data suggests that it costs about $33,000 per doctor to put an EHR in, and that's
just capital and installation. That's not ongoing training and operating costs and the things that go with that. I also think I've read somewhere that something like 20% of American physicians have what they think of as a functioning EHR system in place, which suggests that 80% of them don't. I think if you want to encourage the rapid development of ACOs, you will be encouraging at the same time a more rapid implementation of IT and EHR investments, but I would strongly encourage you not to make it a sort of a day one requirement.
Jeff?
Sure. You know, I would agree with that. I think just quickly, yes, self-monitoring with some reporting I think is an adequate way to kind of get at this. I think on the EHR question, I found the discussion in this morning's panel kind of fascinating that we have some real cutting-edge programs out there that have come at that a few different ways. So kind of stepping back from the two sections that we're talking about in the law today, I think that with the stimulus package from a few years ago, we certainly have a policy driver that's getting healthcare to electronic health records. I don't necessarily think you need to use this authority to kind of further drive that. I think that at the end of the day, if the objective measures that are out there saying the program is being, it's meeting its goals, it's serving its patients well, you know, we're eventually going to get to that electronic health record, but I think that you then curtail kind of innovation and uptake of these programs if you were to require an electronic health record.
Okay. Jonathan.
I come at it from a slightly different angle, maybe ending up in the same place, but part of the way questions are being answered is that everyone has a slightly different view of what these organizations will do, which is good, because that means there will be different types of organizations. But rather than the organization just being accountable to someone outside of itself, the self-monitoring to me seems just a logical extension of what, in my head, the picture of an organization that's committed to meeting the goals laid out in the statute is doing, because the organization comes together to rethink on a day-to-day basis how it delivers care. The example that Dr. Berwick used this morning of the patient transitioning through the Harvard Clinic in that context was it took each of those players to rethink how to communicate with respect to a particular case and then to implement it. Tracking that, whether it requires EHR, massive computer systems or not, depends on the size of the entity. But thinking about communicating either on paper or through email or through a medical record about those changes creates information that should be studied for the function of the organization and then can become the basis for tracking, monitoring, self-policing all the way to a compliance end. I think it would be difficult at this stage to develop a model compliance plan like we have for other industry sectors, just like it would be difficult to come up with a safe harbor, because the elements are going to be different from organization to organization. But that said, it shouldn't be that difficult to require that there be something and that it be that there be a test to see that it is effective and working and that there be improvement and discipline, if necessary, when something doesn't work out right.
I think we'll work our way to the end of the table with Ivy Bear.
Ivy Bear, AMC. I really just want to echo what other people have said, but remind you, there's discussion this morning about the fact that part of what will be built into the ACOs is looking at continuous improvement. So even if you have monitoring, you don't want it to be just against one. So it can, what you're monitoring against may change as folks learn things, and there needs to be reporting because we need to disseminate the information so that when people learn something that others should do or not do, there's a way to get the information out there so everyone can benefit from it. And in terms of Jeff's remark about HIT, I certainly agree with that and just want to remind you that the stimulus bill is giving on the Medicare side until 2015 to become some form of meaningful user, and on the Medicaid side until 2021. So it really is a long process and has to occur in a reasonable time frame.
Great, thank you.
So switching gears slightly, Jen, we'll work to get to you. Wanted to discuss briefly governance structures or governance issues and formal legal structures of accountable care organizations and how that might help achieve success. One thing that we've heard or questions we've received is specifically around Section 3022, which discusses governance, discusses formal legal structure, is that would it be helpful for CMS to dictate specific terms with regard to what a formal legal structure should look like because it creates certainty, or would instead specific terms chill innovation and also increase transaction costs? So wanted to focus on that for a few minutes and talk specifically about that. That's something that I know CMS is very interested in sort of thinking about these issues and trying to figure out the best way forward with regard to these, I think, important questions. So I'll actually start with Chet Speed to lead this off, and then if other folks want to jump in, please raise your cards.
Yeah, I volunteered for this question yesterday morning, and that's the real problem. it was early. Well, when I think about governance, well, actually, take a step back. When I think about ACOs in general, I tend to think of our members as probably some of the earlier adopters of ACOs, you know, beginning in 2012. And when I think about our members, a lot of them have a fairly sophisticated governance structure. When I think about it, they have an executive, administrative, clinical, quality, legal slash compliance, and of course the financing function. And then depending on whether they're, you know, 501c3 or a professional corporation, they may even have a, you know, community board of governors or physician ownership that manages the whole enterprise. So there's a lot of commonalities in the governance structure and a lot of our members. At the same time, there's a saying that once you've seen a group practice, you've seen a group practice. So within each of our members, the governance structure is actually probably radically different from, you know, folks in Minnesota to Wisconsin, et cetera. So as far as the question is it would it make sense for CMS to impose some type of, you know, governance strictures? I think our view would be we'd like, and this was mentioned this morning, we'd like some sort of flexibility because the governance structures are so common, at the same time, so different amongst the members. I think letting them just follow the dictates of the statute, which is fairly broad, is probably the best way of going about the issue of governance, at least from our point of view.
Okay. Jeff Nicholas.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think that, you know, if we think again, what's the themes and the goals we're trying to achieve here? It's innovation and look at a variety of different care models and kind of test them and see how what they're doing. It would seem counterproductive to me to get prescriptive in the way that these organizations really would be governed. I think that, you know, the statute is probably more than enough, really. You have a separate legal structure so it can get, you know, basically the payment and the arrangement. And then there's shared governance, and clearly the statute talks about who can participate, and to the extent that you have some or all of those people in your ACO, then they should be part of the governance. But I think to go much further than that is really going to kind of be, you know, stifling innovation in a way that would be the exact opposite of what we're really trying to achieve.
Okay. Thank you. Tom Wilder.
Thank you. I would agree to some extent. I mean, I think while I would come from the standpoint that I think any waiver, safe harbor, needs to be fairly specific, I think trying to dictate a governance or a legal structure at this point will probably stifle some innovation. You know, there's been discussed here some of the components that I think are very helpful, such as a compliance function, a administrative function, and I think it might be helpful to discuss that in, to some extent, and to help those who want to form ACOs understand what those functions are and how best to carry them out, but to dictate to folks how then they need to put those together in a formal corporate or legal structure, I think, is not necessary.
And we'll just conclude with Marcy.
I fully agree with that. We don't want to be dictating terms on a legal structure because from the perspective of somebody who works with individual providers that form a lot of different joint ventures, networks, and so forth, if you've seen one, you've seen one. It's very difficult to dictate, and I think it would chill the innovation. I think it would, you know, impact, it would potentially impact the ability of certain folks to come together to form an ACO. I think the one thing that obviously we, and I would assume that folks would agree, the one thing we want to be very clear is that whatever governance structures are chosen, they don't impact, they're not going to impact the existing governance structures of the participants. But short of that, I think we really need to leave it up to the individual participants.
Great. Thank you.
I think Jen.
Yeah, Jen.
Well, both this comment and the one I was going to make before have to do with including all players. I would hate to see flexibility be turned into a framework of not being all-inclusive and instead trying to maintain the status quo. So I would make that appeal.
Okay, thank you.
I think at this point we're going to move to the final topic for our panel, which is sort of the future, looking toward the future, looking beyond the waiver authority, looking at what else may be needed and what other considerations that we should be bearing in mind. And this is sort of a compound question for the panel, but a couple of points here that we'd be interested in hearing your thoughts about. One is that for existing ACOs and innovative delivery systems, we'd like to know what is working now under the fraud and abuse laws, and how might we build on this? And then moving beyond sort of the shared savings program and demonstrations that we've been talking about, what exceptions, safe harbors, or other accommodations may be necessary to encourage innovation? Sort of what else should we be thinking about as we look more broadly toward the future? If anybody would like to jump in here, or I can, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I'd like to. I think that what's interesting to me is how much focus ACOs have gotten since the health reform law was put in. And if you're in the conference management business, it seems like a great topic to have. I'm not sure anyone says anything about them, but I really think that, you know, from a hospital perspective, and everyone around the table in there has their own interest, has other provisions they're looking at in the law. But, you know, we're looking at value-based purchasing coming down the pike. We're looking at readmissions policies. We're looking at bundling, and I think that, you know, the discussion that was started with regard to the 2008 rulemaking, looking at a payment incentive exception and a shared savings exception and safe harbors, I think that really should continue, because what I fear here is that because of workload, I understand that this is clear and present and it's now and we've got to figure it out, but the waiver authority really just goes to those two sections. It's not really helping, you know, even if you were to put something out there that's broad, it's not necessarily helping you in other contexts where the way payment is being done, the way that care is being coordinated in different ways than it has been historically are being helped. I mean, I think the payment incentive one is the key one from my perspective. I mean, if you're doing value-based purchasing and you want to be able to tie the physicians in, there has to be some level of incentive that's permissible there. So I do think that we need to kind of think about this and the barrier question to the extent that the fraud and abuse laws are barriers, you know, in a broader context, because the waiver is very narrow, and I think you all should continue to think about policymaking.
Thank you. Ivy Baer.
I guess if we had our druthers, we'd maybe go back to Congress. That Jeff's point, the fraud and abuse laws are written to apply to a system that's based on fee-for-service where the incentives are to increase volume. But as we move to new payment systems, the fraud and abuse risks become different, and you can't easily fit the current laws into different payment systems. We just keep on having square boxes and round systems, and they're not working. And so I think we need to rethink, what do we really need to protect the programs, protect the beneficiaries, but to allow these new payment systems to function freely. And so I think that this is a discussion beyond something that CMS can do, but perhaps as you think it through, you'll be supportive of really considering major changes in the laws that are out there.
Nora Super.
Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say that, you know, you all may be going to a lot of conferences about accountable care organizations, but I want to assure you at AARP we have not had one number call of anyone asking us, when am I going to get my accountable care organization? So it's really not on the mind of a lot of Medicare patients, and I think that that's one of the critical components that people need to focus on is this should be about transforming the delivery of care and one thing that and making that something that patients want. It really can't be just about saving money. And if that's what it's about, it's going to fail, in my opinion.
and that we really need to, I know that's a critical thing that we need to do in the Medicare program, don't get me wrong, but I think that patients need to think that this is better value and that this is a better way to receive care, and that needs to be something that this focuses on. And so I think some of it needs to get out of just talking to the industry and get focusing more on what it is that makes patients understand this is better care.
Great, thank you. Jonathan.
I would actually agree with that. Part of what was interesting about Dr. Broca's story this morning was the role that the patient's mother played in the whole care process and as a member of the integrated team. That was a particular case, but it's that patients are going to have to join in the process and engage in the process. With respect to the question, I'm still back at the exception safe harbor approach will overly proscribe the results of this reinventing, you know, reformation of healthcare that needs to happen, should happen, in order to get that experience to more patients in more locations across the country, large cities and small towns. Innovation is dynamic. And it seems to me that the expectation in the statute is that we're going to sort of not let it loose and let it run wild, but let it loose and let it roll down the track. And so if you have what the problem now, tying back to the question, you know, what is there now and what's the problem? When I'm helping people sort their way through how to organize a PHO or you know, something short of an ACO, the alphabet soup of arrangements that we have out there, the current structure is based on not just the fee-for-service risk, but also the decision that we all made, whenever we made it, that we would focus on paying people by the hour for the work they do. And the difficulty that we've had over time, embracing gain-sharing, shared savings, you know, the fraud and abuse paradigm that we live in now just can't really get all the way around what incentives would be, not just financial for cost saving, but incentives for doing it right or improving the delivery of care or making it faster or, you know, reducing the readmission rate, whatever it is. So that the measure of success that results in payment to a nurse practitioner who's involved in the delivery of care or a physician, you know, that the visiting nurse that was discussed this morning, all of that needs to be reinvented. And the existing exceptions won't work. You have to go get an advisory opinion, and that could take, depending on how many advisory opinions come in on this new ACO wave, you know, 10, 12 years to get one. It's a little joke. But, you know, it's just that the current structure is allowing people to do some of what's desired here, but not to continue to grow it. And that's why another reason the existing structure just doesn't work.
Thank you. And yours will definitely take 10 or 12 years. I think we'll go ahead and recognize the last 3/10 that are up and then take a break before our listening session. Robert Sainer.
Yeah, I just want to comment briefly on your question of what's working now under the existing fraud and abuse laws. And what's working now are highly integrated systems with employed physicians and no physician ownership of anything anywhere in the picture. And yet even that isn't fully protected by existing safe harbors. You have to sort of get in a tortuous way to that final position under the kickback law and sometimes under the CMP law. So I think you have moved well beyond some of what your existing safe harbors protect through your advisory opinions and through things you say publicly, and maybe it's time to bring a couple of safe harbors along to where your current thinking is. I'll give you one example. In these fully integrated systems, there's no safe harbor to protect transfers of money between components of the fully integrated system. I don't think that would be a huge leap for you all to fix that. You said in 1999 that you weren't quite comfortable with that and you weren't ready to fix it maybe
maybe times have changed enough that you could. You have existing policy in several places, for example, on physician incentive plans. There's a nice little physician incentive plan piece in the CERC regulations. Maybe that has applicability in the ACO context and beyond the ACO context as a piece that protects the beneficiary from undue physician incentives to control and cut care. So I think there are things you can do to build on what is working now and move that out. That's particularly important to the smaller medical groups that MGMA represents, because almost all of them have physician ownership somewhere in the picture, and under existing stark exceptions and safe harbors, that ownership complicates everything, even if they are compensated exactly the way they would be compensated in a big nonprofit employment-based model. And in fact, many of them are compensated essentially that same way. So I think there are things you can do to make this a little more user-friendly to a larger spectrum of organizations than the very large, highly integrated physician employment models for whom it now works best.
Ted Speed.
Okay, thank you. I think, you know, for existing ACOs and innovative delivery systems, I think what's working now is a fairly intense focus on fraud abuse statutes and making sure that their provider entities comply with STAR kickback and CMP, et cetera. And I think they do that through the use of in-house counsel, outside counsel, et cetera. And so there's a fairly intense scrutiny internally. But then again, it is sort of like flying a plane or getting into a plane. You know you're safe, but the first time you hit turbulence, you know, you really sort of wonder. And so I think that's why there was a lot of discussion amongst our members about sort of the broad waiver, just to give them the comfort to let them move forward. And as far as the second question, which is what to think about in the future, I think Dr. Wilson mentioned that this morning, that shared savings over time will get to zero. And that's why there's a partial capitation payment mechanism in the statute as well. And so maybe CMS and OIG should start thinking about what the range of issues capitation brings to the ACO field in the next few years.
Great, thank you. Tom Wilder, I think you're going to have the last comment this afternoon.
Thank you. I just want to react very briefly to a couple of comments that were made. And while the fraud and abuse laws, you know, may have been designed in a fee-for-service world, they're really intended to promote, you know, patient safety and the independence of a physician decision-making and to safeguard Medicare funding, and I would just suggest that those goals, which I think are part of the Affordable Care Act, are still valid today regardless of the type of payment model. So I think we should just keep that in mind as well as we're looking at, you know, the how these laws interact with accountable care organizations and what other kinds of waivers or exceptions may be needed.
Great. Well, thank you. I think we want to thank our panel very much. This was very informative, and we thank you. Yeah, we appreciate everyone's participation. We will take a break until 3:10, and then we will start with our listening session, and we hope those on the phone as well as those in the auditorium and our panelists will stick around to offer more views on these subjects. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the conference operator. It is recommended that you stay on the line through the short 10-minute break. Thank you very much.
If everyone could please take their seat. We're going to start in a minute. Okay, again, I am Troy Barsky, the Director of the Division of Technical Payment Policy in the Center for Medicare at CMS, and wanted to introduce the folks who are up here with me. This is not a panel discussion, but instead this is simply a listening session for CMS and for HHS and also for our partners at the Federal Trade Commission to hear your feedback with regard to many of the discussions that we've had today. First, I'd also like to thank our panelists from the last session for the very informative discussion they had. I think will lead us into the discussion this afternoon, focused on a lot of the same themes that we covered previously. I'd like to introduce the people people who are sitting up here. First, Jonathan Blum, to my right, who's the Deputy Administrator and Center Director for the Center for Medicare. Next to him is Greg Dembski, the Assistant Inspector General for Legal Affairs at the Inspector General's Office. To my far left is Elizabeth Richter, who's the Deputy Center Director for the Center for Medicare, and then also Vicki Robinson, sort of bouncing around here, sorry. Vicki Robinson, who's Senior Advisor for Healthcare Reform at the Inspector General's Office. Also, for those of you who are here for the morning session, we have two of our who are our moderators this morning. I'm from the Federal Trade Commission, Susan DeSanti, who's the Director of Policy Planning at the Federal Trade Commission, and to my left is Michael Robleski, the Deputy Director for the Office of Policy Planning. And with that, I just wanted to lay a few ground rules for this afternoon's listening session. This is our time for us to hear from all participants regarding their thoughts regarding the themes that we discussed. We plan to take questions from both those folks who are in the room and then also from folks on the phone line. We will start our process by taking three comments from the floor and then going to our operator to take three calls or take three messages from or comments from the folks on the phone line. If we run out of comments in the room or on the phone line, then of course we'll just continue with the people either in the room or on the phone. As the sort of standing rule for the day, we are going to ask all commenters to keep your thoughts to approximately no longer than 2 minutes in length. Shorter is fine. Also, we will be accepting written comments that we had been accepting before this conference, before this workshop, and we'll be happy to continue to accept written comments at the same email mailbox that was in the Federal Register notice. We're encouraging you to submit those comments within the next 2 weeks. But we, of course, we will continue to discuss these issues with all of you. So with that, I think before I actually turn things over to folks on the floor, I just wanted to turn things over to our operator, Andrea, to give instructions to those folks on the phone as to how they can queue up. So, Andrea, are you there?
Yes, I am. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question on the telephone line, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, star 1 on your telephone keypad.
Thank you. So as folks are queuing up on the phone, we are going to take comments from the room, and we'll start. There are two microphones in the room, and please ask that you walk up to the microphone and if you are going to make a comment. So we'll start with the front microphone and work our way back from there. So go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Danielle Lloyd. I'm with the Premier Healthcare Alliance. We have over 2,000 hospitals that share information together to improve quality and reduce costs, and we, as part of this, have a collaborative with over 75 hospital systems participating in an effort to become accountable care organizations. In fact, 25 of them have the goal of having private sector ACOs by April of this coming year. So we're very interested in this topic, and thanks for the forum. In particular, you all asked about, as the agencies move forward with exercising their waiver authority or expansion of safe harbors, obviously you heard some preference towards waivers there, but certainly not to think just about sharing of the bonuses, but to think about also the other financial arrangements as you started to get at in one of those panels. It was mentioned about capital investments, but there are also other types of payments for primary care physicians, for instance, in coordinating care or achieving certain levels of efficiencies and such. So we urge you to look at that broader than just the bonuses. There wasn't a lot of talk about the provision of free or discounted care items or services to beneficiaries. That's something that we have some constraints on right now in terms of, for instance, paying for transportation costs, paying for in-home assistive technologies, that sort of thing. That's certainly something where we think we can really help patients become more engaged and improve the our ability to increase quality. So it's something that we think you all need to be certain to give us some guidance around what circumstances that we might be able to do that within the ACO model. And then lastly, in terms of reward sharing within the ACO, one option might be to allow the ACOs to put the compensation plan within their application, and if it's approved and they adhere to it, then they'd be free from the scrutiny of stark anti-kickback and CMPs. So something that to think about, and certainly we'll follow up with some additional written comments, but thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. The next person at the front microphone.
Good afternoon. My name is Anne Marie Lynch, and I'm with the Advanced Medical Technology Association, or AdvaMed, and I thank you very much for the workshop today. We did submit more detailed comments, including a brief legal analysis on September 27th, so I encourage you to review the fuller document, but I'd like to make a few key points here today. First, regarding quality of care and patient access, AdvaMed strongly supports initiatives to improve the quality of care and to ensure patient access to high-quality care. We are active participants in the National Quality Forum and other quality organizations. We're concerned, however, that the new ACO provisions in the law provide little detail about how to ensure protection for beneficiaries and their access to appropriate care, including critical life-saving medical innovation. Safeguards and protections can and should be built into the program to protect beneficiaries, and they should include, but shouldn't be limited to, the following: explicit protections for Medicare beneficiary access to medically appropriate care, including advances in medical technology, development of robust quality measures for the care provided by ACOs to offset the financial incentives to reduce the volume and intensity of care, the development of quality measures that monitor utilization in order to detect underutilization of services and technologies to ensure that patient care is not compromised, independent monitoring of beneficiary access to appropriate care, including access to innovative technologies, and importantly, providing meaningful patient notification well in advance of each ACO encounter. The rules have changed, and both beneficiaries and other patients should know it. Second, with respect to the antitrust law considerations and market stability, AdvaMed is concerned about the overall market power that an ACO may wield to the exclusion of competitive forces in the healthcare marketplace. An ACO that encompasses every hospital and every physician and every post-acute provider in a given geographic area would permit no competition and would skew the market power to the detriment of healthcare providers. It may also be anti-competitive if an ACO has a supermajority or a majority of even the largest minority share. AdvaMed is most concerned about the impact on patients of having little or no choice in the healthcare services and items available to them. We are pleased the FTC is considering ways to foster the formation of multiple ACOs to encourage competition in a given market, and this consideration will require an analysis of each relevant market. Such analysis is critical to protect and preserve healthcare marketplace competition for patients, employers, and payers. With respect to the Secretary's broad waiver authority, the law states that the waivers to be used only get, quote, as may be necessary to carry out, close quote, the program. In light of this consideration, AdvaMed recommends that the scope of the arrangements covered by the waiver be tailored so only that those ACOs, arrangements that coordinate care, improve quality, and protect beneficiaries should be eligible. Arrangements between ACOs and third parties, or between providers or parties subsumed within the ACO that are either existing or new, but unrelated to coordinating care, should not be covered by the waiver. AdvaMed received information about a number of arrangements between hospitals and physicians that are not meant to improve quality and coordination care. Here are two examples: hospitalized subsidizing physician office leases or administrative support staff expenses in exchange for the physicians using the lowest cost device without regard to the quality or the individual patient needs, or hospitals and physicians entering into co-management agreements or other joint venture arrangements that enable profit sharing in exchange for, again, physician use of the lowest cost device without regard to the quality or the individual patient needs. The key concern here is that many healthcare entities and physicians could potentially structure their financial arrangements to enhance profit margins without regard to the quality improvement and coordination of care. So expanding the waiver authority would open the door to this activity and presents a significant risk for patients. Finally, the fourth issue I'd like to mention is the creation of a stark exception to the anti-kickback safe harbor. Even after considering today's public input about ACOs that are likely to be created and included in the Medicare Shared Savings Program, without experience and an independent evaluation of the impact of these ACOs may have, it's simply impossible to ensure that there will be adequate Medicare beneficiary protections to safeguard quality of care and access to care. We recognize that the Secretary may grant waivers as may be necessary to carry out provisions of a section. However, for purposes of determining whether to create a permanent regulatory exception to the physician self-referral law, AdvaMed recommends that the Secretary provide a clear explanation of why any risk of program or patient abuse might be appropriate within the shared savings program.
Well, today's workshop is focused on the consideration of the antitrust laws, STAR self-referral law, and the federal anti-kickback statute, and civil monetary penalty laws. There are many other legal considerations that will be important for ACOs. These include, but aren't limited to, federal income tax law and various state laws, such as the state fraud and abuse laws and the state corporate practice and medicine laws. ADMED recommends that the Secretary also take into consideration these legal requirements as she implements Section 1899 of the Act. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Okay, thank you. We'll take one more comment from the room. The back microphone, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Larry Martinelli. I'm an infectious disease physician in private practice in Lubbock, Texas, and I'm here today for the Infectious Disease Society of America. I have one comment briefly on this morning's session in terms of outcome measurement. We are in desperate need of inpatient measurements at the physician level, particularly for those physicians who are either hospital dominant or hospital based. In terms of this afternoon's session, I'd like to make a brief comment on system type measures which may be within or without an ACO. There is the possibility now, and in most hospitals, there are programs in place for patient protection such as infection control and prevention and antibiotic stewardship. And these programs have the potential to have an extraordinary impact both on patient safety and cost savings by preventing hospital-acquired infections, readmissions for complications, by decreasing antimicrobial use and preventing the emergence of infections and resistant organisms. At this point, as the payment system evolves, if the regulatory system does not evolve, then physicians who are not directly employed by hospitals are unable to gain share what may be literally millions of dollars of savings to hospital systems when they design, implement, monitor, and are accountable for these types of programs. And we'd appreciate your consideration as we move forward to allow these types of arrangements so that the credit can accrue where it has been gained. And thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you. At this point, we'll turn to the phone lines. Andrea, if you can queue up our first person in line.
Your first question comes from the line of David Stein with Diaxel. Your line is open.
Hi, my name is David Stein. I'm actually a colon and rectal surgeon at Drexel University College of Medicine in Philadelphia. One of the issues that tends to come up is monitoring outcomes, whether it's different patient safety organizations, the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program, getting objective measures and using these outcomes to be able to compare how you're doing versus equivalent groups or equivalent ACOs is going to be very important. Also figuring out the outpatient outcomes versus inpatient outcomes for large medical groups that are affiliated with different hospitals is also something that needs to be considered strongly. It's going to save you time, and that's all I wanted to say. Thank you again for the opportunity to participate.
Thank you. Andrea, the next caller.
Your next question comes from the line of Cindy Pasha with Families Health. Your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Simine Pasha, and I'm with Families USA. Thank you very much for the opportunity to participate in this listening session. It's such a timely and relevant topic. I'd like to echo some of the earlier comments that we heard about consumer protection. We had some questions about how beneficiaries will be assigned to an ACO, what that assignment will look like, and whether it will have either a real or perceived effect on consumer choice around their ability to select a provider. The other thing, and this is looking a little further down the road at possible scenarios, our own experience with MA plans demonstrates the need for rigorous consumer protections. And so we would have great interest in seeing that there is some sort of equivalence when it comes to standards of accuracy and clarity in marketing materials and similar communications, that ACOs are essentially held to the same standards that MA plans currently are. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that comment. And we'll take one more call from the phones.
Your final question from the phone lines comes from the line of Nicole Fallon with Larson Allen. Your line is open.
Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this session. What is the anticipated timeline for the release of the final rules or guidelines from the FTC and or HHS?
At
I think the best we can say is this fall. So we'll have that.
For the proposed rule.
Proposed rule this fall. Thank you for the clarification.
Anything you want to say?
I think we're working on a similar time frame.
Okay, so we will now go back to the room and we'll start with the person at the front microphone.
Good afternoon. Thank you. My name is Alyssa Keith. I'm representing the California Hospital Association. I just want to thank all the staff and the panelists for an exceptionally informative conversation today, and we really appreciate the opportunity to provide comment. We talked a lot today about the need for flexibility and allowing for experimentation, and to achieve this goal, it'll be critical to create a level playing field from which experimentation can take its many forms. I think many of you know that most California hospitals are not permitted to employ physicians due to the existing prohibition against corporate practice of medicine. California law only authorizes county hospitals and University of California Health Systems to employ physicians, and therefore, as a result, those hospitals are unable to access both the state exemption to the corporate ban and the employment exemption or exceptions to federal fraud, abuse, and self-referral prohibitions. This complicates our ability to take leadership roles in ACOs throughout the state, and would welcome an opportunity to further dialogue with you about this issue as we look for innovative ways to bring physicians, hospitals, and other care providers into ACOs. Second, and on a larger point, as we are now embarking on ACOs and other payment mechanisms that help drive quality, we also, at the same time, HHS currently has its national plan or national strategy for quality improvement that is due to release to Congress in January that hopefully will set forward some goals towards achieving quality improvement. I think the challenge here is alignment and focus. As we're looking at cost and quality measures for ACOs, we're looking at them for value-based purchasing, both on the hospital and physician side. Aligning them with this national strategy will be critical for focusing at the ground level and improving care at the bedside. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. We'll go to the back microphone next.
Thank you. My name is Greg Wallinger. I'm an attorney in Indianapolis with Hall Render. Thank you for having this presentation and panel today. It's been very helpful and appreciated. I'd like to make a couple comments with respect to the provider side. There are so many areas which the government could focus their time on. I would like to urge it to focus on a few, which I think would alleviate a lot of the issues. Number one is a focus on the civil monetary penalty statute with respect to its prohibition on reducing services as opposed to reducing medically necessary services, as well as examining even further options to allow incentives for preventive care. I think that would be good for beneficiaries and it would be good for providers. Number two, I would like the government to strongly consider finalizing the exceptions for the shared services and the incentive payments under STARC. That is needed. Those have been out for a few years, and I think that would be a big thing for the provider community. And number three, re-examine the electronic health record subsidy exception and safe harbor in light of the new health reform, and look at ways that it could become more contemporary and more permanent. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I will go to the front microphone.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Jim Kaufman with the National Association of Children's Hospitals. There are three issues I wanted to touch upon. First upon, there was a lot of great discussion about commercial ACOs and Medicare. One payer that I noticed was missing was Medicaid. So I'd be curious with CMS's view on Medicaid and pediatric ACOs. With Medicaid covering one in four children, it is the largest payer of children's health care services. So how do you envision incorporating children's health care in the ACO model?
So I think we're very conscious of the fact that this is not just a program for the Medicare program, but also for all payers. And to the extent possible, we'll be coordinating with our colleagues in states on the Medicaid side. So that is a CMS priority to ensure that what we're building for the Medicare program also has close tie-in and collaboration for states as well.
The second issue I have is related to exclusivity. When you were talking before about providers, whether it should be exclusive ACOs or open to multiple providers, the one thing with children's hospitals, usually you have one or two children's hospital in a given market. If you are required to be exclusive with a ACO and you have four or five ACOs in a market, you may actually be creating barriers to accessing care at a children's hospital. This last issue I wanted to mention was regarding measurement. There was a lot of talk about measurements and how to include appropriate national measures. The only request that we have is you include appropriate pediatric measures nationally in the development of the commercial and Medicaid ACOs. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll now turn back to the phone line. So, Andrea, if you could give us our next caller.
So, again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. And your next question comes from the line of Albert Weinstein with Physician. Your line is open.
Hi there. My name is Dr. Weinstein. I'm a vascular surgeon in Atlanta, and I think the effort today was excellent. I think, though, that you need to consider one of your main challenges, and it came up both in the morning session and again in the afternoon session. And that challenge is, how do you put in place these ACOs in a way that is pro-competitive and doesn't allow the large academic centers within a particular market to dominate by purchasing and employing physicians? I'm in private practice. Our group, which has a clinical integration model in Atlanta, is one of those that I think is an excellent model for that 60 to 70% of patients that get their care through private practice. And I'm wondering if you have any comments about that.
No, we don't have any comments, but we appreciate your observation.
Thanks.
Andrew, we'll take the next caller.
Well, there are no further people in queue. So, again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
Okay, Andrew, we do have someone in the room here, so I think we'll go to the person in the room, and then we'll turn to you in a few minutes. So the person at the front microphone.
Hi, my name is Julia Hesse, and I'm inside counsel for Tufts Medical Center and our affiliated physician organization, New England Quality Care Alliance. And we're located in the People's Republic of Massachusetts. And one of the many things that's great about that is that our state has implemented a number of ways in which quality and efficiency data and cost data is being reported. And I would encourage you, to the extent that you can, to collaborate with the regulators at the state level, because I think that a theme we heard in both the morning and afternoon sessions was that consistent reporting of quality data and cost and efficiency data is going to help all of us achieve our, I think, generally recognized and mutual goals of improving quality and reducing cost. And having the provider community have a gazillion different quality metrics that we're complying with that are often payer-specific as well as specialty-specific impedes our ability to do this. And so we see at the state level that because there is becoming standardization required by the state, that's advancing the ball at least a little bit. And so I'd encourage you to work with the states to demand that people implement a single system of quality measures. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for that comment. The next person at the microphone.
Yes, I'm Ross Stromberg with PricewaterhouseCooper and the People's Republic of San Francisco and Berkeley. If by chance one or more of your agencies happen to grant a waiver, will that to an ACO that is certified as meeting all the standards under the 3022, will that waiver be broad enough to also apply to the commercial side of the business? In other words, if you're doing business in a certain way with Medicare, you almost are going to have to do the same kind of business with the same kind of arrangement, the same kind of sharing of interests on the commercial side. Have you given any thought to that?
I guess I'll start at least from the Stark perspective, and I don't know if Vicki would want to comment on the OIG and the kickback and CMP perspective, but you know, at least from our sort of authorities, we're really only able to focus on referrals for claims that are submitted to Medicare, sort of from the federal perspective. And obviously, I think a lot of our thinking with regard to sort of ACO structures and sort of beyond the Stark and legal issues that we've been talking about today, I think we'll get to a lot of the issues between both federal payers and private payers. But at least from our perspective, the Stark perspective, that's not really something that we will be focusing on.
I think similarly for the OIG's authorities,
Those authorities affect Medicare, Medicaid, federal health care program business and referrals of federal health care program business. There are some types of arrangements and some situations in which payment on the commercial side or payment on the private side may spill over onto the federal business, and it's those intersections where we look, we have to look at those laws. So we are certainly considering how this will impact more broadly across payment arrangements on the commercial and private side, and looking at how we can provide guidance or a waiver or whatever needs to be done here that is appropriate that will take into account the issue you raise, which is the desire to have consistent payment arrangements across the commercial and federal side.
How about the FTC?
Yes, we are thinking about that, and we recognize, and one of the reasons we're participating in this so heavily, we recognize that many ACOs are going to want to participate in the private marketplace. And so what we're looking at is the potential to have safe harbors that would apply for Medicare and then also in the private marketplace, conditioned on your operations being the same in the private marketplace as received approval from CMS.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next commenter from the room.
Well, my name is Tina Erging. I'm with Decision Health in Gaithersburg, and I was wondering if any of you could provide comment or insight on what role independently owned long-term providers such as home health agencies might play in an ACO framework.
I mean, I think that's a question for ACOs to, you know, to determine themselves. I mean, I don't envision that CMS proposed regulations would dictate precisely how such post-acute care type arrangements might work, but I think that would be something for an ACO to bring to CMS with their own proposal.
Thank you.
Okay, and we'll just turn back to the phone lines and see if anyone is queued up on the phone lines.
Yes, your next question comes from the line of Hal Teitenbaum with Crystal Run Healthcare. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Hal Teitelbaum from Crystal Run Healthcare in New York. I'm just hoping that in considering waivers and or safe harbors, that both the FTC and HHS takes into consideration the need to put function over form. And I think this issue has been raised previously, but for example, a Geisinger-like structure operating as it does in a relatively rural area in Pennsylvania works in a fully integrated system, but would be much more difficult from an antitrust perspective if we were talking about a joint venture, clearly with much more than 20 or 30% of the market. And when you look at an area like the one in which our practice operates, where a multi-specialty group, you have a situation where because of the demographics, we're not urban, we're not densely suburban, one group could easily, or a ACO could easily extend beyond 30% market share, could be providing improved quality and lower cost, and yet violate technically some of the restrictions as they currently exist for joint ventures in healthcare practice. A second comment would be that, again, looking at the New York market, where physician-owned practices are physician-owned hospitals are virtually non-existent. Again, much contracting between hospitals and physicians outside of academic centers is going to be exactly that, through contracting. And I would hope that, particularly when we look at Stark and the civil monetary penalties and anti-kickback statutes, that we take into consideration the specific differences in marketplaces throughout the country, including New York, where a lot of these arrangements do have to be done contractually and not through an employment model as might be possible elsewhere.
Yeah, thank you for that comment and perspective. The next caller on the phone line.
Your next question comes from the line of Michael Cook with Lilies Parker. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much. I have a question to expand on Ross Stromberg's and the counsel from Tufts, and that is, has any thought been given to trying to expand or encourage a demonstration to encourage ACOs to look at an all-payer type of a demonstration. Maryland does something like that with their hospital system. Obviously, this would be a lot broader.
I think there's two ways to answer that that question from a CMS perspective. First is that under the statute, we have to create a shared savings program for the Medicare program.
Sure.
But I think, as Dr. Berwick and others have said, that our goal is to ensure that we're well coordinated with other payers to ensure that we're complementing, not undermining other private sector efforts. There is authority within the statute, the new Center for Innovation, that has to be set up by January 1st, 2011. And I think Congress had contemplated that innovation authority as being a possible vehicle to work with other payers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next caller on the phone.
Your next question comes from the line of David Klosky with McDermott Will End. M, your line is open.
Good afternoon. It's David Klosky, partner with McDermott Will and Emery in Los Angeles. Two points that I would want to touch on that haven't really been addressed to this point are incentives for patient access to care, and then also expansion of protections for incentives for efficiency within ACOs. On the first item, in our work as outside counsel to the premier ACO collaboratives, we've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence of access issues that impede the ability to ensure that patients will be compliant with their treatments, and would certainly encourage consideration of further liberalization of the ability of healthcare providers to provide appropriate incentives to patients to accomplish those goals, be it free transportation and other type of assistance. In an economy such as this one, and even in good times, it is amazing sometimes how very trivial amounts of money are the real difference between a patient with chronic diabetes being able to attend regular doctor visits and comply with their meds, the failure of which ends them up in the emergency room at great cost to the Medicare program. Particularly in an environment in which patients are assigned to an ACO based on their pre-existing relationship, we certainly feel that there are sufficient protections in the system that the traditional concerns about program integrity would be safeguarded in this area. Secondly, I think the point was made in the earlier panel discussion that achieving triple aim outcomes is going to be difficult if ACOs do not have protection with respect to the process by which those triple aim outcomes are achieved. And certainly finalization of the shared savings or incentive payments exception to Stark and a kickback safe harbor would be a step in that direction. But I think, in large measure, the lack of progress made on that effort over the past years has been a result of a lot of pushback regarding the highly complex and very restrictive nature of the proposed exception in safe harbor, and that in the spirit of promoting innovation and experimentation that has been cited consistently throughout today's session, that perhaps a more liberalized approach in that regard would be appropriate. And I think it is particularly appropriate from the regulator standpoint in the context of ACOs, where you have two factors that are not typically present. One, under the Medicare Shared Savings Program, you are committing yourselves to a finite 3-year agreement. And so you're not in the position of having to blindly bless arrangements for all time, but rather you will have organizations applying for Medicare contracts and have the ability to approve or disapprove those arrangements. While these obviously also affect the commercial market, again, as was mentioned, the structures put in place for the Medicare side will also apply in the commercial venue as well. And so basically you have that protection of finite period. And secondly, you have reporting of information as outlined in the statute, which would provide regulators with all of the information they would need to determine if there were undesired outcomes resulting from these relationships. So, for those reasons, I would certainly encourage you to consider taking a much broader approach to protecting incentives paid to providers within an ACO that are aimed at incentivizing achievement of those goals. So, whether it be, gain-sharing type arrangements between hospitals and physicians or whatnot, that unless folks have certainty with respect to those arrangements, it's going to be very difficult to get ACOs off the ground. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for that comment. And I do want to, for the rest of our time period, just have the speakers and commenters be mindful of the 2-minute requirement. I have not been enforcing that yet, but I'm about, as the time gets shorter, I will become more strict from here on out. So with that, we'll turn back to folks in the room. And start with the front microphone.
Thank you. Thomas Barkham with Baker Donaldson in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm speaking on my own behalf, but we have a number of clients that are looking at developing ACOs. And despite the fact that I'm a lawyer, I will stay within 2 minutes. First of all, I think it's important that you consider allowing ACOs to make financial payments to patients for financial decision-making, cost-effective decision-making. I think that would really allow ability to get patients involved in the process. I would also say that, unlike when we built integrated delivery systems in the 90s, today it's very ugly, meaning that, one hospital might have a pay-for-performance arrangement with its IPA, it might have a medical co-management agreement with its cardiology department, and it has employed physicians. I think if you're building a waiver or a safe harbor, it's important that you take into account that there's a lot of pre-existing arrangements that have incentive compensation, and that those arrangements be accepted. And then the final issue is really just for your awareness. It's more of a legislative issue, and that is, we have a lot of providers that operate in several states. Remember the 90s, a lot of states adopted anti-managed care law. I mean, it would be nice if Congress would have given preemption here so we had a level playing field as opposed to dealing with these issues on a state-by-state basis. And that's it.
So can you clarify your first point about ACOs being permitted to provide financial payments to patients? Are you referring to differences in copays and cost share, or what more precisely do you mean by that comment?
Well, I think the ACO could actually say we're going to allocate a portion of the cost savings of total care that will go back to beneficiaries for effective decision-making based upon cost data. If you put that transparent information out there, they can see different sites of care, different costs for those sites of care, and they can make a decision that way. And if you can track that through your system, then you can take that pool of funds and distribute it back to patients, which I think would get patients more involved in the process than simple data transparency. And that's it.
All right, thank you. We'll go to the back microphone next.
Thank you. Randy Fenninger, Holland Tonight. Just an observation. We've spoken mostly about physicians and hospitals and the arrangements for ACOs. There are many health systems that incorporate health plans, which are interested in this, and to the extent that that health plan may become a central part of the operation of the ACO, may have a bearing on your considerations, both of the FTC as well as looking at the other statutory interaction between the private sector and the public sector. So I just wanted to raise that for your awareness and information. Thank you.
Thank you. The next commenter at the front of the room.
Hi, thanks. I'm Dr. Curtis Lowry, and I'm chairman of the OB-GYN department and director of the Center for Distance Health at the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences. And one thing I've learned at this meeting is that attorneys talk a lot more than doctors. Arkansas is a very rural state where we have a huge population of underserved individuals in the rural areas. As director of the OB-GYN department, we need to train more physicians. And as you know, CMS has not dramatically increased the monies for training of physicians for quite a few years. We had to pick up a fifth resident in our department, and we did that at department revenues because it's very important that we increase the number of OB-GYN physicians we train in our area. And the second thing is that we have one of the largest telemedicine programs around the nation, with the idea that we're going to try to support the primary care physicians and nurse practitioners and other individuals practicing in the rural areas where you have a hard time getting physicians and other practitioners to go. And there needs to be some thought about, one, training more providers, and two, how do you support them and encourage them to go into the underserved areas? You can't form ACOs if there isn't anybody to form an ACO with, ultimately. So that's one of the things I'd like to see happen.
Yeah, thank you very much for that comment. We'll next go back to the phone lines and see if there are any more folks in the queue.
Your next question comes from the line of Jerome Connolly, a private practice physiotherapist. Your line's open.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having this session today. I represent the private practice section of the American Physical Therapy Association, and that membership is about 4,000 independent practicing physical therapists who are small independent businesses, community-based. And I'd like to express the appreciation of the difficult path that the agencies must walk in trying to lay out the framework for ACOs, particularly as it relates to the issue of exclusivity. While of course you desire to promote collaboration, at the same time, allowing providers to negotiate in among themselves could create an opportunity for collusion. By virtue of forming an ACO, individual practitioners, ACO professionals as defined by the statute, will need to determine who is included in the ACO and who is not included in the ACO. But independent community-based providers, such as private practicing physical therapists, are by nature in competition with not only the services that are provided in the hospital, but also in some cases in competition currently with some of the services that are provided by physicians. So this is a difficult indeed path to walk, because exclusion from an ACO could mean an impact on privately practicing physical therapists or other non-physician providers. It could mean a lack of freedom of choice to the patient. So the way you set up the framework and the model and the waivers for this particular entity are going to be extremely important to this particular cohort. For that reason, I would really appreciate any comments that members of the panel have, but also would like to encourage CMS to convene one or more listening sessions for non-physician providers to talk about things like this and talk about governance and also talk about the electronic health record, which, as you know, there are no funds or no stimulation for private entities or other than physicians and hospitals to become funded and up and running on HIT. So there are a number of inherent issues here, some legal, some implied, but I would appreciate your consideration of those points. Thank you very much.
And thank you for those comments. Just to let folks know, on the phone, our panelists have been dismissed, so I think you won't get any further independent analysis from them for today. But we do encourage you, and as I said at the outset of this afternoon's listening session, if you have further comments, written comments, we do encourage you to submit those, and CMS will consider those as we work through the regulatory process. So the next question on the phone.
Your next question comes from the line of Michael Callahan with Captain Nutchin Rosen. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. That was close enough. Just a couple of comments. I know you're trying to end up here. One of the comments made and the questions dealt with the issue of monitoring, both internal and external. I don't think there's any question that there needs to be both. And how else do you determine whether an ACO is being successful in terms of outcomes, controlling costs, et cetera? There also needs to be sufficient transparency to patients and payers, et cetera. My concern would be, and just something to keep in mind, is that we also have the Patient Safety Act with the development of patient safety organizations, which allows for the treatment of all of that information as privileged and confidential. And so it's taken a while to get hospitals and physicians excited about that and truly understand it. And my hope would be that as you think about monitoring what has to be reported out, that we don't inadvertently undercut the protections and the goals of fostering open communication, of fostering physicians and others to come forward, acknowledge issues, problems, so that it can be a healthy discussion about those kinds of problems so that, you know, quality can improve. So, you know, keep that in mind if you can. And then secondly, because I have technical difficulties in trying to connect this morning, I don't know if there's any comment about when you look at the ACO certification requirements and taking on some of the indicia, what we would call clinical integration, whether those were developed in concert, you know, with the FTC, with the idea that if one becomes certified, I don't know that there is a determination that you have now achieved sufficient clinical integration or maybe a presumption of integration. Maybe that's something Doug Hastings talked about. But, you know, that some guidance along those lines would be very helpful, recognizing that we're really talking about the private payer side and not the public payer. So thank you.
For your comment, that second issue is something that we are actively considering. So thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jeffrey Brenner with the Camden Coalition. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit citywide coalition focused on improving the safety net in Camden, New Jersey. It's one of the poorest cities in the country. We have multi-hospital involvement, so two hospitals, three emergency rooms, all of the local FQHCs and private practices. We have found that the high-cost complex patients who are often dual eligibles move from hospital to hospital and are quite mobile, and it would not work to have three competing ACOs in this marketplace, that the intervention really requires collaboration across multiple domains, multiple providers, multiple hospitals, which obviously creates antitrust issues. Will there be, much like the rural issue, urban communities have many of the same problems, if a state were to design a legislative model for Medicaid urban underserved ACO in which Medicare could participate as well, would you imagine the federal government delegating some of the responsibilities for oversight to the state in order to ensure patient protection and prevent monopoly and steering of patients?
I'm not sure that there's so much we can say at this point from a CMS perspective. I think as John Blum had stated earlier, especially with regard to Section 3021 and the Center for Innovation and some of the models that they will be exploring over the coming months and years, I think that that could definitely be an area that they could and will explore in the future. So encourage you to submit those comments around that area, and we can those folks are not up here on the dais today, but we will definitely pass along those comments to them.
Thank you.
And we will now turn back to the room and to the back microphone.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Mills with Proskauer Rose, the law firm. I just had a couple of comments on the rural issue. First, if you're going to give relief anywhere on the 15-85% cost allocation for EHR installation, please do it in rural areas where the benefits of having connectivity and interoperability are and the opportunities for telemedicine and so forth are so great. And second, as we face the physician shortage and the continued difficulty in recruiting and retaining physicians, both primary care physicians and specialists in rural areas, I would encourage re-examination of the physician recruitment and retention restrictions and exceptions, and also some consideration of how hospitals can help specialists do outreach without the hospital employing all physicians. That's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. If there's no one else in the room here, I'll turn back to the phone lines.
At this point, there are no questions on the phone line either.
Okay, so any last chance for comments in the room or comments on the phone, or if not, we will conclude the session for today.
So on the telephone line, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad.
Okay, I will take that as a no. I wanted to thank you all for your participation today and appreciate all of the thoughtful comments and the work of all the panelists in both the morning session and the afternoon session. As I said a few times, we encourage you all to submit further written comments that we will consider very carefully. We have already considered all the comments we received previously, and we will carefully consider all further comments you submitted. So thanks again to everyone, and this was a great session. Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.